This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Donvan in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Centuries ago, Christopher Columbus set out to discover what he thought was India. But as the story goes, his perceptions were a little bit off. 500 years later, writer Siddhartha Deb made a reverse trek. He went from the U.S. to India, which is his homeland. In a way, he too found himself exploring a new world, the India that stands at the heart of globalization. He actually went undercover in an Indian call center to better understand globalization's effect on the young people who were flocking to what seems like opportunity. But he discovered that this change is not affecting everyone the same way, that millions are being left behind. We'd like to hear from you in this discussion. If you have ever lived in India, has the change been for the good or the worse? Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Later on in the program, we'll be looking at food stamps and fast food. But first, let's do this in-depth look at the new India. Siddhartha Deb writes about his experiences and the people he met on his journey in his new book, The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India. He joins us from our New York bureau. Welcome to the program, Siddhartha.
Thank you, John, for having me here.
So you're... in this case, I want to point out that you're actually a novelist,
but
this was not a work of fiction. This was closer to journalism, I would say. So you went back to do journalism about the new India. Why?
Well, I was interested in the changes that were happening there. Obviously, it's a lot of people experiencing change in new ways, in some sense. And I had got the impression that there was a very triumphalist version of this change, which was that the country is doing very well. There was even a slogan that was coined by one of the political parties. It was called India Shining. And I was going back. I was writing feature articles. I was a freelance writer. And I was somewhat skeptical of this. It was pretty obvious that at the upper levels, people were much better off materially than they had been in the past. But certainly large numbers of swaths of people seems to be untouched or mired in the same poverty, or sometimes even worse, because they could now see these incredible contrasts. So I wanted to examine that. I wanted to do that by looking at the new rich. I wanted to look at people who were in the middle, people who were middle class. I wanted to look at people who are very poor and who are the majority but invisible. I wanted to do it by, getting a firsthand sense of what things are like, by talking to people, by interviewing them, by spending a lot of time with them. It wasn't journalistic. It was more like what you call immersion journalism. Mm-hmm. It involved spending sometimes weeks with people.
Well, and the style in which the book is written still reads like a novel. It is full of color and texture and even sights and sounds and smells.
Thank you. That was very much the intention, to write something like a nonfiction novel, if that's possible. So the facts aren't made up. They're very scrupulously researched. I've tried to be as accurate as possible, but I wanted the texture, the flavor of a novel, of people in motion in some sense.
Can I say that the story that you've written reads to me as a very sad story?
That's a fairly reasonable interpretation. I think it's a sad story to me, too, in many ways.
And even among those who feel that you describe an engineer named Chuck who is building a house. He had lived in the United States, and he's now building a house in the American model. He gives you a tour. He even uses American language. This is the open plan kitchen. This is the master bedroom. And yet you portray him as his desires as being somewhat hollow, as though he's not a happy man himself.
Well, I mean, I think Chuck would see himself as a happy man, and I think that's reasonable. I've tried to allow people that space. But yes, I, as a narrator, come in, and I do sometimes question what some of my characters are saying. So when someone like Chuck says, he did say this, that there are these incredible contrasts in India, but that's okay. We're kind of one big happy family. And I question whether that's really the case when, you have at the very top end of the country, say something like 66 billionaires, and these numbers might be slightly old, but there are probably a few more billionaires since I last checked, but 66 billionaires who seem to have something like 30% of the country's wealth. On the other end, you have like 800 million people, over 800 million people living on less than $2 a day. When you have a country where 40% of the children under the age of 5 suffer from malnutrition, it seems to me that these contrasts aren't really healthy. They're not just differences. They are really like living different worlds within the same country. So yes, I actually come in as a narrator and I question when, say, Chuck is a character, he sees his life as thriving and successful. And I think that's reasonable again. But I also question the fact that this house, this special zone in which the house is constructed, is being built on what is a demolished village. And I have very hard questions. I think this is very troubling, what is happening to the country. And even the people who are doing materially, yes, I think there might be a certain hollowness. I don't know that having more things necessarily makes you happier, by which I'm not suggesting that people shouldn't have, you know, things.
You speak so much about geography in this book. As you say, the Chuck's house is in a special zone. Mm-hmm. And a couple of times you actually use the same language in different parts of the book. You talk about an area near where he lives, and you talk about software complexes built along the Outer Ring Road, their cool gleaming exteriors shimmering like mirages amid the rubble and scrubland of an area where city and village meet in an uneasy convergence. On another page, you talk about a company called Fuller Life. Again, the word uneasy, the location evoking the uneasy juxtaposition of the old and the new that is so characteristic of contemporary Bangalore. And you seem to be very much in the book, you keep walking across that line back and forth between the old and the new, between the shiny and the shabby. And you're very uncomfortable, it seems, by what's meaning there.
Yes, that's very well put. I mean, I imagine that change is always kind of painful and troubling, especially change on a large scale. I do question that, you know, some of the changes that have been happening in India, whether it's been done with any kind of thought to the hundreds of millions left behind. I think that I have, that's where the uneasiness comes from, as if the rural has nothing of value to offer to India, as if the fact that 500 million people make a living from agriculture is just something old and outdated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as if, you know, software engineering, this only employs a little over 1 million people. We do have to ask as a society, what is going to happen to the large majority who are not software engineers and who probably don't want to become software engineers and who won't be able to become software engineers? I think that's not been asked in any way. And I think, again, we're talking about this rubble or this urbanization. It's very breakneck. It's often very ugly. It's often displaces villages, you know, highways cutting through villages, cutting a village into two without providing an underpass for villages to go from one side to another.
That's an excellent scene where you're picking your way across a superhighway.
Exactly. I have to walk across the highway between Bangalore and Hyderabad on foot. I cross the highway with the villagers because, you know, there's no underpass.
We're speaking with Siddhartha Deb, who is author of The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India, and we've asked you to call in, particularly if you have experience having lived in India. And I want to go to Ankish, who is in West Michigan. Talk to us about Ankish, about what we're talking about here.
Again, my name is Pankaj in West Bloom, Michigan. I agree to some extent, but I know I've lived in India, born and brought up till 2000, came here in 2000. I think I've gone to India like 7 or 8 times so far, at least once a month a year. There has been big changes, like the globalization at a higher level has actually impacted at the lower level a lot. Slowly, the growth has trickled down to the common man in terms of better infrastructure, better employment opportunities, better business opportunities. So the contrast is there. That's not going to go away in like a decade, but it has come down. The gap between the rich and the poor is not going up. It's rather coming down.
So, Ankush, you're saying that the trend is in the right direction as far as you're concerned.
The rate with which that gap is narrowing down is not acceptable. It's very slow, but you see the difference. If you go to places like Delhi or Mumbai, where I usually go, you will see a big contrast between poor and need, you know, the rich. But when you move away from the metro cities, you can see that, yes, the life has improved. In the last 10 years, the number of cell phone users in India is many more than anywhere in the world.
All right. Ankush, so, you know, thank you for those insights. And I want to have Siddhartha have a chance to respond to them. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I mean, I think the numbers don't bear those out, the idea that the contrasts have reduced. Actually, I don't think there's any doubt that at the upper level, the rich have become much richer, and that within the middle classes, people are actually making more money and are consuming more. Often the number of cell phones is a very favorite figure. It's very interesting. When I spent time among the farmers, they did have cell phones, but they didn't feel that they had become empowered in any major way because of having cell phones. I mean, it was convenience. And when I was speaking to the migrant workers in a factory when I spent some time, they actually, many of them didn't have cell phones. One of the more things they were concerned with is they didn't have ration cards that they could use to buy subsidized food. So some of the fundamental, struggles are over things like food, water, land, and maybe mobility, in some sense, education. And that hasn't changed. And the numbers are not good, the numbers that come in from various sources. Just recently, a minister in Central India, in Delhi, suggested that, anyone making more than 32 rupees a day in Delhi should be considered above the poverty line. 32 rupees is like 80 cents or 70 cents. He was laughed at roundly. I mean, you can see this New York Times story where the reporter is going around asking people in Delhi how much they can, how many meals can you eat on 32 rupees a day? Mm. And people laugh. You can make maybe one meal a day on that. So there's... you do see in the cities, you see cell phones, you see televisions, you see more consumer goods, but large numbers of people are living in abysmal conditions.
As they were before, however.
As they were before.
Let's talk about that when we come back. We're talking with Siddhartha Deb. His book, again, is titled The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India. And if you've ever lived in India, we want to ask you to give us a call. Tell us whether you feel the change has been for good or not. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. I'm John Donvan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm John Donvan. Siddhartha Deb opens his new book, The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India, with a description of himself as a child growing up there, and then moves on to a chapter in which he explores the life of the very, very wealthy. And the interesting thing about that chapter one, Siddhartha, is that it doesn't appear in the Indian version of this book. Why not?
That's absolutely right. It's the only edition in the world that chapter doesn't appear in, which I think itself is very telling that, the rich and the powerful are not happy with any kind of scrutiny. It's a fairly nuanced, sympathetic look to a very wealthy person. He's an entrepreneur. He owns a large chain of business schools. He's a producer of some Bollywood films. And very flamboyant, very energetic. He's a management guru. His name is Arindam Chaudhary. And I spent a significant amount of time with him, talking to him. And I have a critical but nuanced portrait. But it was accepted in an Indian magazine, after which what happened was that his company filed a defamation lawsuit, but not in Delhi, which is where his company is based and where the magazine is based as well. They filed it thousands of miles away in a very small court. And the court issued an injunction without allowing us to respond. And the suit was filed against the magazine, my publishers Penguin, me, and Google India for some very strange reason, accusing us of all working for his rival companies. Mm. And as a result, it just wasn't possible legally to publish the chapter in an Indian edition until it's resolved, which may take years.
So the book is thinner.
The book is thinner and censored. But I guess the strange thing that has happened is that people have been buying the book in India and they download illegal versions of the chapter that float around on the internet, which has nothing to do with me or my publishers.
We're talking with Siddhartha Deb, the author of The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India. If you've ever lived in India, we want to ask you to tell us whether you think this shift to a modern global economy has been for the good or not. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can visit the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. In the chapter that has been censored, you have a very, very, you bare your soul, I think, for a very, very interesting paragraph or two in which you've been rubbing shoulders with the very, very wealthy. You talk about their ability to incite jealousy and the desire to aspire to who these people are by their own show of wealth. And then you look at yourself in a shop window and you, for a moment, you feel the same jealousy. You say, I wondered why I didn't have a suit, designer glasses, and car keys. I wondered why I wasn't making money at this time in India when money-making opportunities seemed to be everywhere for the asking. I was an aspirer, finally oblivious to anything but my own inchoate desires, filled with a sense of victimization as well as a trembling awareness of opportunities that it was perhaps not too late to capitalize on. So you were bitten, at least in that moment, you were bitten by the get-rich thing that you, in most of the rest of the book, have a great deal of skepticism about.
Yeah, I wanted to humanize. I'm sympathetic to people aspiring to more material wealth, and I'm critical at the same time. I think it is possible to be sympathetic and critical at the same time of certain things. I mean, essentially what we are seeing is that a certain section within India wants to catch up with the West, and they want to catch up in the West at some very obvious levels, at material wealth, big armies, you know, big shopping malls. And in a way, I can understand why. I mean, it's a great culture. It's a very old civilization that's been deeply humiliated through a great part of the modern era, partly because of colonialism. It has felt itself sort of out of the loop, and so people want to catch up. And I'm sympathetic to that. But that doesn't stop me from being, and you know, in the same way within India, there's a segment of people who are doing very well. And yes, there's something wonderful to, you know, wearing a nice suit and, you know, wearing designer glasses, carrying a laptop, feeling like a certain kind of citizen of the world. This is the phrase that would often come to me from the well-to-do. But, you know, there are all kinds of citizens of the world, and we can't forget about everybody else.
Well, you do say a few paragraphs later that the moment passed and you got over this episode of envy and greed. Let's bring in Chris from McKinleyville, California. Chris, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon, folks. I lived in India a long time ago and have been back twice, and I'd have to say that globalization has helped materially a lot of Indians, but until land reform and land rights issues are honestly dealt with, I think the vast majority of Indians are going to be left behind.
Siddhartha, care to comment?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by land reforms or land rights, actually. Well, I mean, I don't mean that in a critical spirit. I just don't understand that part of it.
Personal land use, personal land right, land ownership is a lot of times held in village title, and the village elders a lot of times get to decide what is done with the land, and that was the whole land reform, the whole concept of land reform and land ownership is a hot button topic all over India.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, the land issues in rural areas, that's a colonial legacy where, you know, the British instituted somewhat different sort of systems because they were interested in extracting revenue, and they often created some rather bizarre ownership patterns. But within India itself, you know, in rural areas, it varies widely. It depends on which states we are talking about. There's a lot of variation. And in states where there's relatively low education, relatively low in terms of equality, where there's much more of a caste, class, gender hierarchy, essentially you tend to see land holdings in the, you know, very small, very landlords holding a lot of land. In states where there's been some kind of education, more sense of rights, there's been something more of a reformation and basically more people have rights to the land. At the same time, a lot of people are basically, a large category of people in rural India are what we call landless laborers. They don't really own anything. They work on other people's lands. So it's really coming down to the question of what does it mean to be a citizen? And are these people equal in the same sense? And constitutionally, they are. The Constitution is pretty, it's a pretty remarkable document. But it's not enforced, you know. When you go to the policeman, you're not as equal as somebody who owns land.
You know, Siddhartha, to that point, And Chris, thank you for your call. There's another way in which you describe these people that you're describing right now. You used the word, I just happened to notice this, you used the word worn or worn out several times in the books, both to describe the slippers of people who are walking around looking for work, but even the people themselves. You describe a woman who say she looked older but more worn down, and you describe the workers at a steel plant. So effectively, you say the men appeared shabby, and their bodies looked worn out by the work, shorn of flab, without being muscular. And what does worn out mean? Worn out means not of use anymore, not having a place, and to be thrown out. And is that what you're trying to communicate? Is the experience of people who are in this category of not being part of the surge upward that they can't ever get a piece of it?
Yes, and I think it's terrifying to say, to contemplate that it's true of such a majority of people, that if they haven't been educated, if they're not already working, say, in companies, in private companies, doing kind of not manual labor, not physical labor, but, you know, paper-based work, then if they're not part of what they call the knowledge economy, then they are useless in some sense. And that's terrifying to contemplate.
Let's go to Tommy in Northville, Michigan. Tommy, you're on Talk of the Nation. You're free to speak. Go ahead.
Okay. I have been in this country for 25 years, and I have been traveling back and forth over the past 25 years. And the major change I see is in the political structure, which gives a lot more empowerment to the people. Earlier on, they had a socialistic system where everything was controlled by the government, including businesses, the so-called license raj, and people had no motivation to aspire to do better because they were in a government job and you got your promotion based upon your years of experience or seniority. But now, people don't look to the government as the primary source of employment. They look to the private sector, they look at starting their own jobs.
Tommy, is it your sense that that the average Indian is making use of those opportunities?
Yes.
Yes.
They are much better off. Earlier on, they were, depending upon the state you live in, either they were bonded laborers or there was a distinct class of people, which led to the rise of communism.
Siddhartha, what about that?
There are still extremely large number of bonded laborers in India. We're talking about one of the industries in which there's something called bonded laborers is called the brick kiln industries. These are very small scale. The fact is that the majority of the people are untouched in some sense by opportunities, which is why, again, a majority of people are interested in government jobs because it's a very large employer. There is a great degree of inefficiency connected to the government, but that's not entirely an accurate picture either. The license raj is something that's bandied around quite a bit. Essentially, when India became independent, Indian industrialists, big Indian industrialists like the Tatas and the Birlas, were among the very people who wanted a very centralized government structure. They wanted the government to participate. And essentially what happened through 40 years, it wasn't a completely closed economy. It allowed Indian industries to grow. It allowed engineering colleges that were heavily subsidized by the government, which produced those engineers who've gone on to the world. And then it produced a kind of middle class that became confident enough to compete with, you know, the West, basically. But now that that's been done, it's been happened for the middle class. It's happened for 150 million people or so. We don't want that to happen for the rest of the people. And one of the things that's not talked about is affirmative action in terms of caste, that is extending benefits to people who've been oppressed hugely. Now, one of the reasons that they want a government job is because the government's jobs have affirmative action worked into them, and they are different, there's different percentages depending on which state you're in. Private jobs, there's no such thing. And so private jobs naturally go to people who are capable of taking advantage, upper caste, urban, educated. I'm not saying they don't deserve to have these jobs.
But you are saying, in a sense, that socialism created the basis from which this burst of capitalism launched.
Exactly. And it wasn't even social. It was more like a mixed thing. It was in part social. There was plenty of private enterprise before Coca-Cola. When Coca-Cola got thrown out of India in the 70s, you know, when I was growing up in India in my 20s, we had Indian sort of drinks, like, you know, they were sort of fakes. But that's partly what allowed that great copying, was what allowed a certain kind of talent to emerge. In fact, when you go to India today, and you go to the smaller towns, or you go to the edges of the cities, the bulk of what's being sold are not Western branded goods. They are knockoffs. Hmm. They are fakes.
Tommy, thank you for your call. Let's bring in Cheryl from Houston, Texas. Cheryl, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. Yes, I just flew in actually from India, and I was looking for the NPR station and came upon your program today, which is
good timing.
Extremely interesting to me. I've lived in Bangalore, India, for about 7 years, and I'm married to someone that was originally from there, and we moved back from the U.S. So I have a perspective from, you know, living there on the ground right now, and I can tell you that the food and the cost of everything for my maids, my driver, it just goes up and up and up. And, you know, I think that they, even though we pay them well, I think we pay them, you know, above average. They're probably getting 13,000-14,000 rupees a month from us, each of them, and because we're paying for their schooling, their health care, and their salary, and their living accommodation, so they have something, you know, decent to live in. You know, it's just they can just keep ahead of themselves. They can't really save long term. So I guess we're helping them save with educating their children and giving them good health care and everything. But I think that, you know, the cost for them just keeps going up and up.
Okay.
Another thing positive I would say right now is that there is a lot more money there, and I do see some people with money wanting to do something good. And the company that I work for is Indian-owned, and they have a good healthcare clinic, and they provide free healthcare in the afternoons for people. So I think I'd like to see more of that there.
So, Cheryl, you're basically saying islands of progress. And I think, Siddhartha, you acknowledge that in your book.
Oh, yeah. I think I agree that. But, you know, the cost of living that Cheryl pointed out, the cost of food, nobody wants to talk about that. I mean, I'm very glad you brought it up. It's gone up tremendously. And again, if you are middle class and above, if you have a certain kind of, you're above a certain level, it doesn't affect people that much. But at the bottom of the ladder, which is where the majority of people are, the bulk of their income is spent on food. The $2 a day people, the bulk of it goes on food. So if food prices go up, it affects them disproportionately compared to other people.
Beautiful and the Damned is the name of the book by Siddhartha Deb. We're discussing his portrait of the new India. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Siddhartha Deb, the title, The Beautiful and the Damned, obviously lifted from Scott Fitzgerald's saga of the Jazz Age. Mm-hmm. And I'm absolutely, because I know you're a novelist as well, that's no accident. So what's the point you're trying to make?
Well, it's a bit of an Indian Gilded Age with cell phones. And I think, you know, it's the Gilded Age with the internet thrown in. So everything's visible. So there's that same flamboyance, that same kind of energy that you see in the upper classes, but the same kind of, you know, absolute lack of caring, a lack of awareness about what's happening for the majority who are kind of pushed off to the sidelines, who are invisible. And I think those contrasts are what I am trying to push. And I'm trying to push a debate about those contrasts, about this materialism, which is both attractive and tawdry at the same time.
Detkin in New York is joining us on Talk of the Nation. Hello, Detkin.
Hi. My husband and I lived in Bangalore for several years, so we're certainly not natives and we're not experts, but I think the main impression we take away is that India has always had this huge dichotomy between the rich and the poor, and it's always had a massive number of people living on just scraping by, like you say, and I just wonder why, you know, why is this talk of globalization the thing that really gets us to finally address this thing that has been an issue for so long?
That's a terrific question, yeah. Siddhartha, what about that? I mean, it's in a sense, what you're describing is new, but it's not new.
Well, what I find interesting is a number of the people have said they lived in Bangalore. And Bangalore is, that's very interesting. Bangalore is much more globalized, or globalized in a particular way. No, I think what has changed is that there were these contrasts growing up. There was very much there, these contrasts between the rich and the poor. I think there was a sense of a shared future and that something had to be done about people who were less fortunate. Sometimes that impulse came from people because they were socialists or communists. Sometimes it came because they were religious and because
because they felt that they were connected, there was a sense of, you know, a duty. That has disappeared. And now there is this sense of, you know, the people who've done well deserve to do well, and the devil take the rest, basically. That's what is new. And there's also a lot of criticism of the government. And I'm very critical of the government myself. But I end up defending it, because often the critiques of the government, that the government is inefficient, it becomes a kind of hidden way. It's almost like the Tea Party kind of, you know, an Indian Tea Party version of saying the government is very bad. But the government, the legislators, the bureaucrats, they are elected by a large majority of Indians. And one other thing about India is the poor vote in massive numbers. I do not think they are represented very well often, but it is still some form of representation, and I don't want to dismiss that so quickly attacking the government.
As ever, a land of contradictions. Thank you very much, Siddhartha Deb. Your book is called The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India. Thanks so much for joining us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, John.
Coming up, should food stamps be used at fast food restaurants? Sherry Tussler argues that nobody else can tell us what to put on our plates, and she joins us next. I'm John Donvan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.